Welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from finally a reasonably nice sunny day here on Aotea, Arafaro Bay. It's Thursday, the 21st of August 2019, I believe. Thanks for tuning in today. This show, this broadcast of On the Brink Radio, for which I'd really like to thank Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV for her amazing dedication to making this show happen ever since 2012, and amazing effort and dedication far beyond the call of duty. I'd also like to point out that I'm sitting on the deck of my cottage, and so you're going to hear any sounds that I hear here. You're going to hear vehicles go by. You're going to hear a bit of the wind. The wind just rustled one of the pieces of roofing. It's quite windy. You might hear backup beepers, and hopefully you won't hear any chainsaws, lawnmowers, whippersnippers, and you might hear some airplanes coming over, but this is the real bioacoustic environment in which I am intimately connected with here on Aotea. And it was the subject of my very first show back here a couple of months ago, because I was just blown away by the amount of anthropogenic noise here. But that's not the main topic of this show. The main topic of this show, it's called Bandy and the Morpork, a story of amazing kinship with the birds. Now, New Zealand, Aotearoa, originally, this is as we understand it now, originally had no mammals whatsoever except for one species of bat. And I forget its name. And it still exists. I don't even think it's endangered, but a species of bat was the only mammal here on these whole islands. And so the dominant life forms on the land were, there was an additionally, there's a few reptiles, some skinks, and there's this kind of an ancient dinosaur lizard called the Tuatara, which I've never seen one, but they're here. But these islands are known to be islands of the birds. The bird kingdom just went crazy here, probably more exclusively than any other known place in the world that was exclusively bird habitat for millions of years, and very, very large varieties of birds, and many of them were flightless because there was no predators. They tended to not prey on each other, and so they were able to grow to really huge sizes and be flightless. For example, there was a bird called the moa, which was kind of like a giant ostrich or emu-like thing that was probably, I don't know, got 3-4 meters tall. It was huge. And then they were finally driven to extinction by the Maori here several hundred years ago. But New Zealand was islands of birds. Even Joseph Banks, who was the naturalist, forgive me for my ignorance, he was a naturalist that was with one of the explorers who came here, possibly James Cook. But I remember reading Joseph Banks said that when they were had their boat anchored offshore of Banks Peninsula, or, you know, which is Akaroa, the giant volcano down near Christchurch on the South Island on the East Coast, he said that even if their boat was like a quarter of a mile offshore, the dawn chorus of the bird singing was deafening to them even at that distance. And this was all like in the 1700s. So it was just it would be impossible to know what it would have been like here with the birds and the sounds. And my partner Lisbon and I were down on a place called Ulva Island, that's ULVA, off of Stewart Island, or Rakiura, the southernmost big island off the tip of the South Island of New Zealand. And we were recording the sounds of the forest there, and it was just almost completely lacking in bird songs, although you'd think there'd be heaps there. And then one of our films that we made, we created a collage, an experimental sound collage for a couple of minutes of what it might have sounded like before Western man came. And so we just sort of layered in the sounds of many different birds that we believed might have existed at that time. So if you could go back even further in time, what it would have sounded like here and what it would have been like with an island populated by millions of birds and no mammalians, no predators. It would have been an amazing, amazing place. So anyway, here on Great Barrier Island, one of the things that we still have is lots of bird life. And some of them are, of course, imported species. And then there's a special term for ones that actually aren't indigenous here, but they came on their own. Like rosellas can fly over from Australia, and other birds like that. There's magpies here. There's birds, many varieties that we hear that are quite vociferous when it comes to the singing thing, that aren't indigenous to here, but they're all part of the landscape now and seem to exist pretty harmoniously together. And my friends John and Peggy Ann said that since they've planted a lot of shrubbery and trees and stuff on their property, that they've noticed a greater number of birds, because I think they, you know, that's where they live. They like the foliage because they can hang out and be safe from predators, many of which are other birds, sort of, you know, your raptors and stuff, like your eagles and hawks and kites and owls and stuff. They actually hunt other birds and, you know, small ground animals and insects and things like that. But, you know, the bird kingdom is known for its song. And birdsong may be one of the earliest inspirations for human music. And I, especially here on Great Barrier Island, more than anywhere else, I'm able to just sit outside and paint and hear the birds. And just listening to their songs, when it's not being interrupted by anthropogenic noise, is totally mind-blowing. How intricate and beautiful they are. And trying to understand, I don't think it's not something we can translate. The whole idea of translating is similar to our conception of language or intelligence. These are concepts created by a special mode of functioning of our own brain mind that don't necessarily reflect the real reality behind any of this. They're convenient maps that we like to use, but we tend to get trapped in the maps. So understanding birdsong, there's just something about it that when you hear, you're able to grasp what it's communicating at a level that's completely non-linguistic and non-verbal. And the ancient Egyptians used birds to symbolize their beliefs about spirit. They had the concepts of Ba and Ka, two dimensions of the human spirit, that you see in their hieroglyphics represented by little pictographic birds. Once I was house-sitting in Fjordland, and I found these two little dead warblers, or birds of some kind, dead side by side on the deck. And they had flown into the glass and killed themselves, but I painted them on a rock and buried them, and I called them Ba and Ka. We've got little sparrows chirping right over my shoulder here. The wind has died down. So it's just really, really amazing here, the sound of the birds that are my beautiful, beautiful friends. And some of the ones that we are most intimate with here are the tuis, which is an indigenous New Zealand songbird. They're black with a little white cotton ball-like thing on their throat. And they have the most amazing songs, some of which are so freaky that if you didn't know it was a bird, you wouldn't be sure what it was. You've got the ruru, which is the Maori name for the moorpork, and which is in Australia called the boobook. And he goes, woo-hoo. And they go all through the night. I've been very, very intimate with them. There was one here that used to come up and sit in the tree in the daytime. You've got the kakas, which are very articulate and eloquent, and they're a parrot, kind of similar to, like a North Island version of the South Island kia, the iconic New Zealand alpine parrot. They are quite mischievous, and sometimes they eat certain kind of berries that are fermented at a certain time of year, and they act like they're drunk, flying around at night, making all these raucous sounds and stuff. And sometimes people don't like them because they come and eat their nuts, their macadamias, or nibble on their citrus, grapefruits, and lemons and stuff like that, but I love them. You've got the seabirds. There's albatross, which I don't really see that much, but heaps of seagulls. You've got the gannets, which are the ones that fly along, and then they'll dive straight down into the ocean and get a fish and come back up. And then on the beaches here, we've got oyster catchers and dotterels, which are two sort of ground-dwelling seabirds. They can fly, especially the oyster catchers, but they like to spend a lot of time on the ground, and the dotterels are endangered, and they're indigenous, this type of dotterel, only to here. But they're really susceptible to extreme tides and waves, and also especially to people's dogs running loose on the beach, which I have to say, that is that of all the environmental issues here on Great Barrier, that's the one area in which I have seen an improvement in the past couple of years, is people keeping their dogs on the lead and in the right areas and stuff like that. And I'd really like to thank Chrissy Dews and the other animal control people, and also Roger and Kylie, the police, for helping us keep people from driving on the beach and stuff like that. You've got the kereru, which is the wood pigeon. And I think the Maori used to like to eat them, but there's a lot of them. They make a really loud sound when they fly. So you'll sometimes startle them when they're sitting on the fence post next to when you walk by. They're quite cool. You've got the kahu, the native hawk. You see him soaring over, kind of gliding, looking for bunny rabbits and other things to eat. You've got the kakarikis, the beautiful little... They're kind of like small rosellas that live around. They really like to live at the Okiwi Kakariki Nematon. It's the reserve at Okiwi where I do rock painting with the school kids. They live in the holes in the trees, and they've got beautiful, beautiful little ratchety sounds. You've got the gannets, which dive down. You've got the piwakawaka, or the fantail, which is in Australia called Willy Wagtail. He's got a very vibrant sort of musical sound, and his tail kind of wags back and forth. Now, among the sort of imported birds, I think that are European imports, you've got the sparrows, which you can hear around me now. You've got the chaffinches, which is kind of like a little sparrow. He would come and ask for food last year. He would just make this little chirp, chirp. You got the magpies, which are quite cool, quite vocal. You got Storybird, which is actually a skylark, but he has a beautiful song. He'll sort of hover over the dunes and sing a non-repeating song that goes on for almost as long as the sound of the thrush, who are the master songbirds here. They'll just go on and on and on and on with a seemingly non-repeating fantasia of beautiful songs at day and night. And last week there was one, it was an absolute concert right at sunset for about 10 minutes. You got other little birds called yellowheads. You got shorebirds called ibises and herons and stilts that you see down around. I see them out at Herotonga. But the bird that I'm most familiar with and has been my closest friend is the banded rail. I don't know his scientific name, but we call him Bandy. Lisbon and I used to call him Bandy because they'll come and walk around the yard looking for food, and they're quite friendly. They're not afraid. And so I've had a lot of birds come into my cottage over the year. Bandy would come in and even bring his little babies, which are so cute. It's a little early in the year for them. The thrush would come in with its babies. The ducks would come in with its babies. Sparrows come in. Chaffinch. The duck is the only one that we sort of have a problem with. Not, but they're just a little too persistent. If they find even one little thing to eat, they keep coming back every 5 minutes. And I don't really mind, except for they'll squirt out a puddle of poo wherever they happen to be standing, which might be inside. So, but nothing against the ducks. Anyway, but Bandy. There was one certain Bandy that would come ever since I've been back and give him a few crumbs here and there. And he would come inside and walk around, and he had a way of getting your attention. If he wanted a crumb and there was nothing, he would come up unexpectedly and pecked me on my big toe with this little beak. And the very first time, I go, it kind of hurt. I go, oh my God, it's Bandy. So he did that quite a few times. Anyway, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Bandy came around and he was hopping on one leg. And I go, Bandy, what happened to you? And I couldn't tell whether something tried to get him or if he got hit by a car or something, but he seemed all right. He was kind of holding it up. And I was hoping it would come right, but I didn't try to grab him or check it out or anything like that. And probably should have called our friend Karen Walker at that point, but I just thought I would give it a chance to see if it came right. So anyway, over the next 2 or 3 weeks, Bandy was hopping around, and we'd give him a little extra food. And John and Peggy Ann, during the week I had to go to Auckland. You know, here's another anthropogenic noise, the sound of a backup beeper. This is one of the more gentle noises that I have to be subjected to here, but I hear this probably dozens of times a day. But if I can hear that, don't you think the birds can hear it too? So anyway, Bandy was coming around, hopping, and he seemed to be doing okay, but I was worried if the other leg was going to give out or if it was just getting stronger. But he was fine. Seemed to be doing okay. But then one day, about 3 or 4 days ago, I was sitting here painting exactly where I am right now, staring in the exact direction where I'm staring right now. And I looked and I go, wow, what's that? And it was a bird sitting on the ground right next to my medicine wheel and right next to a big caca that I painted on a rock. At first I thought it was sort of a big fat thrush because it had spots on its abdomen, but then I zoomed in on it with my camera and it was a moorpork, the owl, the ruru, sitting there on the ground, which I'd never seen before. And I go, wow. And I went like, well, that's really cool. And I go like, oh my God. Well, the Maori legend says that when a moorpork comes, it means something's going to die. A person or something like that. And John said it's actually if 3 more porks come, that meant they believed somebody was going to die or something. But anyway, I don't really believe all that stuff. I like the more porks. But anyway, I zoomed on in on this more pork sitting there, but all of a sudden a thrush came and was standing there less than a meter from the more pork, and it was looking at the more pork and just going off with its sound like it was cussing out the moorpork or telling it to get lost. I mean, that's exactly what it sounded like. Did that for like 10 minutes. So then the moorpork flew up and sat on the corner of the tool shed on the opposite side of the garden, but so it could still look down and have a vantage on anything going on down in the garden here. But I didn't really think. I just went like, well, it seems unusual that for the moorpork to be sitting out in broad daylight in full sunshine. And he looked like he was sleeping most of the time. I did quite a bit of filming. He would open his eyes occasionally and look around, but he mainly seemed to be sleeping. But John and I wondered if something was wrong with him. So we called Karen Walker, the beautiful woman on this island who takes care of birds, among other things. But she's renowned. She's not a vet, but she's able to nurture birds back to health and has a lot of sort of veterinary techniques that she can use to bring birds back to health or do whatever steps are necessary if they can't seem to be able to regain full level of health. So Karen came over and she took her little net for catching birds and was going to scoop up the moorpork, and he just flew off. And that was really cool because earlier that day, John had asked me, he said, Jeff, did you ever hear the sound of a moorpork flying? And I'm like, well, you know, I know they're owls. I've never been close enough to one, but owls are known to have special feathers that make their flight silent so that they don't alert anything that they're trying to catch. So anyway, right when Karen walked over and was going to put the net around the moorpork, it just flew away. And interestingly, during that exact moment in time, there was no noise. There was no wind, no planes, no lawnmowers, no sound. And so during this interval of silence, the moorpork flew, and it made no sound whatsoever. So that was really, really cool. It's like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? What is the sound of a moorpork in flight? So anyway, all the birds had been going off the whole time the moorpork was here. They were alerting each other to its presence. The sparrows were sort of ratcheting the whole time at an elevated level because I pay very close attention to the sound of birds. That's why I like to be outside so I can hear them. in between when it's being interrupted by anthropogenic noise like planes and lawnmowers and chainsaws and whippersnippers and helicopters and all the stuff, I constantly monitor and feel at home with the sounds of the birds. The thrush went off, the tui had been making alert calls. Three piwakawakas were joined together sitting on a limb, the closest limb to the moorpork, and they took turns swooping over around the moorpork. They weren't attacking it, but they were certainly flying around it, making all these sounds. And the moorpork didn't even bat an eye. It didn't act like it was scared or anything like that. But Bandy was around, hopping around, and he was inside, and he seemed to be lingering inside more than usual. And I went like, well, it's nice. I guess he feels at home inside. And I went in and was going to give him a little crumb of bread. And he kind of came over to me. And I just felt an energy from him, stronger than I've ever felt, that he wanted to be with me, or he wanted me to pick him up or protect him or help him or something. And I really, really felt that looking in his little eyes. And I felt his spirit, his heart. And I gave him a little piece of bread. I didn't try to pick him up, but anyway, while Karen was still here, I went like, you know, maybe Karen should take a look at his little leg and see if it's something she can help with. So I closed the doors on my cottage, and Bandy couldn't get away, which he didn't mind, but Karen came and got him, picked him up and started examining him, and he had a piece of string wrapped around his little leg, which I don't know how it would have got there, but it's definitely not something natural. And the leg was kind of tied up in a bent position, so she started trying to undo the string, and she ended up taking Bandy back to her house to remove the string. And she got there and was able to remove the string, and she was able to determine that the circulation in his leg was good. The leg was warm, wasn't damaged. So she's given him some antibiotics and said he should be good as new in a few days, and so he's going to get to come back and join us and come and peck me on the toe and be with his little family again. I'm not sure if it's a male or a female, but anyway, that was so special. But what really flashed in my mind was that Karen told me that the moorpork was actually scoping something that it wanted to eat, which was its unusual behavior of being right here. And so she said that the moorporks actually hunt all these little birds, the sparrows, the chaffinch, the thrush, the banded rail. And I'm like, oh my God, the moorpork was probably scoping Bandy because he was injured, hopping around, meaning he would be an easy prey. So that explains why Bandy was inside and why he was reluctant to go outside, because the moorpork was there. And I only realized this later once Karen explained about the moorporks. It doesn't make me think any less of them, but still, my instinct is to nourish and protect and nurture any life form that I can, especially a little Bandy that's been my friend, that pecks me on the toe and will eat a piece of bread out of my hand. So he's going to be okay, but this is the main message of the show, that I felt plain as day in my heart, in my mind, and with my own eyes. I felt the spirit of this little bird reaching out to me for help in a moment of when he could see it's something that could eat him, sitting up on the roof of the shed there. And also the solidarity exhibited by all the different varieties of birds, the tuis, the thrush, the sparrows, the piwakawakas, were all alerting each other to the presence of this predator that could eat any of them. That was just so, so cool to witness these beautiful solidarity behaviors among the different species of birds. It's a true sense of community. This is really what community is. Exhibiting here in all the different ways, the community of between the humans and the birds, and between the birds and themselves, and even the predatory community. So the birds are very intimate friends of mine here, but this is an example of Bandy having the piece of string around his leg. That's an example of a problem, a very big ecological and environmental issue all over the earth now, is animals getting entangled or entrapped in human rubbish, like string, and especially in the ocean. Whales and dolphins getting trapped in fishing nets and sea turtles and plastic, that whole thing. It's a huge, huge, huge problem. And another issue that I talk about a lot here on Great Barrier and was the subject of my very first show when I came back a couple of months ago, the bioacoustic noise level issues. Any sound that I can hear, the birds can hear. And any sound that blocks out their song to me is going to block it out to them. And so you can't really point out any particular incident, although there are noise levels here that I constantly monitor and record that are loud enough that to completely disrupt or block any kind of song or sound from any kind of animal. So for whatever purposes they use sound, communication, territorial, alerting each other to danger, just the sheer joy of singing in honor of being here now, any anthropogenic noise anywhere intrudes on all this, and it's a huge, huge, huge issue. One of the major problems of Great Barrier Island, especially Arafura, where I am right now. Another problem affecting all of the birds is the whole poisoning scenario, especially here in New Zealand. 100% clean and green New Zealand has the highest level of pesticide use in the world and one of the highest levels of cancer. These two things are not unrelated. But part of the DSC propaganda is that, oh, well, you know, the 1080 just magically kills only the things we don't want, like all the rats and mice and possums and stoats and weasels. But that's not true. But even if it were, the poison goes into and is eaten by everything else. And so anything that dies from the poison, its carcass is going to lay there, and it's going to be riddled with the poison. And then all these birds, like especially the raptors or the predators that might eat something that's been poisoned, whether it's alive or dead, that poison is going to go into them. So I just have an article from a couple of weeks ago about how they think that the moorporks in Auckland are dying because they're being poisoned by secondary poisoning from the food that they eat being poisoned. So this is called secondary poisoning, and also bioaccumulation is another aspect of the poison scenario that doesn't kill something outright, but it gradually builds up in our tissue of any life form. Another problem here on Great Barrier with the birth that I've pointed out has seen improvement is dogs on the beach, but it's still a problem. Any dog that's not on a leash is not under someone's control, regardless of what they say. So all they have to do, here's the beautiful backup beeper coming again. Have to hear this about once every hour. Dogs really don't belong on a place like this. And a lot of people, the beach, and especially even in Australia too, the beach exists as a place for people to walk their dogs. And it's just, I like dogs, but there's a time and a place for them, and it's not here. And another huge, huge issue of which we're waging war on the bird kingdom and other animals is the destruction of their habitat. Every time a tree is chopped down or even pruned, the possibility exists that you're taking out nests of birds that already exist or potential places where they could nest, holes in trees for kookaburras. When this guy had a bunch of indigenous trees cut down here across the street a couple of years ago, we realized that the neighborhood became a lot quieter just after that because he had taken out so many bird nests and stuff. And the people that do this don't even think about this. It doesn't even cross their mind. Another problem with birds and any ground-dwelling animals, especially in Tasmania, is automotive traffic, cars running over and hitting animals that are trying to cross the road, and birds. You see little ground-dwelling birds here called pukekos get hit quite often, and also even kotaris, because they build nests close to the road and they might dart out in front of a car. So the key is to just drive a lot slower. If you have to drive, drive slowly. And I got a shocking report last week from a researcher named Mark Broomhall, who is a scientist in Perth, Australia. He He's been studying the biological and ecological effects of these electromagnetic and microwave installations on a mountain called Mount Nardi, N-A-R-D-I, in Nightcap National Park near Mount Warning, up near Byron Bay in New South Wales. And he's been studying it for 15 years and has made a very definite and direct correlation between the increase in the transmission power of these installations and towers with a noticeable decline in bats, birds, and all different kinds of wildlife in that area. So I really want to call attention more than ever to species of life that are teetering right on the brink of extinction, right in front of our eyes, due exclusively to human behavior. And especially here in New Zealand, the Maui's dolphin is right on the total brink of extinction, right in front of our very eyes, only a couple of dozen or fewer breeding females left. This is in a country that spends tens of millions of dollars to proclaim to the world that it's 100% clean and green, one of the most biggest contradictions of any people, any country in this whole planet. And the same thing is happening in Australia with the iconic little koala, a beautiful little marsupial. He's not a bear, but he's kind of bear-like, the koala. That by estimates, there's fewer than 80,000 of them left in the whole country because their habitat is being viciously deforested all up and down the whole East Coast. So I'd really like to thank my friend Allie B. on Magnetic Island, or Yunbanoon, because of her work with the koalas. Yunbanoon has one of the healthiest and largest populations of koalas in all of Australia, and there they're protected, except for there they get chowed on by dogs. Stupid people with their dogs off the lead can get a koala because they're not very fast. If they're down on the ground, they can't just run up a tree like a goanna can. Also greatly endangered, the vaquita, a beautiful little dolphin down in Mexico. Many, many, many varieties of songbirds. My friend David Stewart, the songbird recordist in Australia, noted that he's noticed a vast decrease in the number of small songbirds all over Australia in recent years, and that seems to be a global phenomenon. You've also got the greatly endangered mountain gorillas that were the friends of Diane Fossey in Rwanda. Their numbers have come back, but they're still under threat from the poaching, as are the rhinoceroses and elephants, because people in China want them for their tusks, for some kind of medicinal hocus-pocus. So I've made up a word called ecomachy. That's E-C-O-M-A-C-H-Y. That means war on our home, because ecos means house or home in Latin. So the Homo sapien macrovirus is conducting warfare on our home, Mother Earth, the beautiful planetary being whose children we all are. I'd really like to ask everyone to ask more of yourselves and to really critically evaluate your life. Are you on your highest path? Are you a soldier in World War III? Are you a passenger of Mother Earth or a crew? Is any of your behavior help you to qualify as an oxygen thief or wasted protoplasm or excess baggage rather than being an artist whose greatest work of art is you, who asks not what Mother Earth can do for us, but what we can do or stop doing on behalf of Mother Earth, to wake up every day and, instead of looking out for number one, to ask if you can be of service in the greater picture to all of life? These are questions we all ask while we do still have time. I don't think that anything we can do is going to prevent civilization from getting taken out really soon, because it's just so far gone. It's a threat to life far beyond what any of us can imagine. But we can hope to lessen the severity of the purification, in the words of Thomas Bunyaki, the Hopi elder who I met in 1986. So please stay tuned. Please live simply so that others may simply live. Ask more of yourself. And stay tuned on Brink Radio, where I'll be having a new series of interviews with Dr. Nick Begich starting in September. And I'm returning to the land of the Dreamtime in the middle of September. Sending love and light and blessings. Kia manuia, kia ora, and be good. This is Jeff Wefferson signing out from On the Brink Radio. Good day.
Thank you. Thank you. Every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on UCY.TV.